Good morning and welcome to the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. And thank you all so much for being here today for our second hearing to focus on the aftermath of the landmark Supreme Court decision in Massachusetts versus EPA. The Bush administration's approach to climate change policy has been to deny the science, delay the regulation, and dismiss the critics. The administration's denial of its own authority to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act led to the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts versus EPA almost 1 year ago. The Supreme Court decision made a few things exceedingly clear. Greenhouse gases are pollutants that can be regulated under the Clean Air Act. EPA's excuses for its failure to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles, including its excuse that the Department of Transportation sets fuel economy standards, were all inadequate. Under the Clean Air Act, EPA must determine whether these emissions cause or contribute to air pollution which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare, a determination often referred to as an endangerment finding. And finally, if the EPA does make a positive endangerment finding, it must regulate greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles. In May of last year, the President directed EPA, along with other agencies, to prepare a regulatory response to the Supreme Court decision. In June, the Select Committee held a hearing at which EPA Administrator Johnson appeared. He told us he was working on both the endangerment finding and the proposed regulations. And numerous statements made by him and other administration officials during the next 6 months indicated that the EPA was on track to issue a proposed rule by the end of last year and have final regulations in place by the end of this year. Well, that did not happen. Instead, what we've learned from a steady stream of press reports and congressional hearings is that EPA, in fact, concluded that greenhouse gas emissions endanger public welfare and submitted its finding to OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, in December. EPA, in fact, drafted greenhouse gas regulations for motor vehicles and submitted its draft to other agencies in December. And then, according to numerous reports, EPA stopped all of its work in this area, except for its work to deny California, Massachusetts, and more than a dozen other states the right to move forward with their own motor vehicle emissions standards. And instead of cooperating with Congress, EPA has answered congressional inquiries for information with delays and denials that interfere with the work of this committee and other committees in the House. In stark contrast to EPA's failure to lead, we have here today two witnesses who have been climate heroes in the state of Kansas. Unlike the EPA administrator, who still cannot accept the scientific consensus and declare that greenhouse gas emissions are dangerous, Kansas used its own state authority to deny a permit for a new coal-fired power plant on just those grounds. For its trouble, Governor Sebelius' administration has been subjected to an ad campaign comparing it to Vladimir Putin, Hugo Chavez, and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and the sponsor of the coal-fired plant, Sunflower Electric, has engaged in a full-court press to change the law to its liking because it could not show that a new coal plant would not endanger public health or welfare. Today, the committee seeks answers from Administrator Johnson. We are seeking documents we have been requesting for almost 2 months. We want an answer to when the last remaining environmental ministry head in the developed world will decide whether greenhouse gas emissions are dangerous. We will be looking for an answer to the question of when the federal government will begin to lead climate change policy by example instead of by doing everything possible to thwart the states who try to do their part to save the planet. I think our witnesses today have an enormous responsibility. I thank them for testifying today, and I recognize now the ranking member, from the state of Wisconsin, Mr. Sensenbrenner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Global warming is a complicated and nuanced topic that needs smart and carefully devised solutions. And because the policies needed to achieve greenhouse gas reductions also stand to damage our economy, these policies must be both economically and politically feasible. Left in the hands of regulators and the courts, greenhouse gas reductions could have serious consequences on our economy and our way of life. And I'm afraid that the Massachusetts versus EPA Supreme Court decision runs the risk of putting this political question in the hands of unelected regulators. Should the EPA determine it should regulate greenhouse gases through an endangerment finding, the effects could be far more reaching than anyone imagines. We're not just talking about new cars and ultimately power plants. As Peter Glazer of Troutman Sanders LLP will testify today, this could include several types of buildings, including small factories, assisted living facilities, indoor sports centers, and even breweries. And where I come from, we don't like the sound of that. By focusing on two laws, the Clean Air Act and the Endangered Species Act, the courts stand to extend the scope of these laws far beyond what they were intended to accomplish. Neither of these laws were written to deal with global warming, and using them in an effort to regulate greenhouse gases will result in a mishmash of policies that will have a heavy hand and an unpredictable impact on the economy. Regulating greenhouse gas emissions through the Clean Air Act is particularly onerous, as anything that qualifies as a source, like breweries and assisted living facilities I have mentioned above, would have to receive the proper permits from the EPA for any type of expansion. This permitting process is expensive and time-consuming and would come at a time when these expenses could create a heavy drag on the economy. There has to be a better way. One of my principles in evaluating global warming policy is that it must advance technological progress. I'm not sure how EPA regulations can accomplish this. Additionally, I'm confident that EPA regulation of domestic greenhouse gases wouldn't be emulated by other countries, specifically China and India. By unilaterally enforcing greenhouse gas restrictions, the EPA could put the U.S. at a competitive disadvantage. By using the Clean Air Act and other laws not intended to regulate greenhouse gases, activists are attempting to use the courts to push through heavy-handed regulations that will result in significant trauma to our already slowing economy. I believe through technology we can find ways to control greenhouse gas emissions without causing that harm, and it is an alternate path that we must pursue. I thank the chair and yield back the balance of my time.
The gentleman's time has expired. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Washington State, Mr. Inslee, for an opening statement.
I'm afraid waiting for the Bush administration to act on global warming makes waiting for Godot look like an action-packed thriller. We are waiting with no action, but the planet is not. The ice cap in the Arctic that melted and lost 1 million square miles of the Arctic, the size of six Californias, did not wait for the Bush administration. The oceans that have 30% more acidity because of dissolved carbon dioxide, which may be a partial reason for the destruction of the salmon runs in the Pacific Ocean this year, is not waiting for the Bush administration. The far west, which is in the seventh or eighth year of a drought, with consequent damage to the agricultural industry, is not waiting for the Bush administration. And I just find it inexcusable reading a quote from November 8, 2007 from EPA Administrator Johnson. Quote, "In addition, since the Supreme Court decision, we have announced that we are developing a proposed regulation to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from mobile sources. That is the first time in our nation's history, and I have committed to members of Congress and to the President that we will have that proposed regulation out for public notice and comment beginning by the end of this year. and to work toward a final rule by the end of next year. The planet is not waiting. And just to know, this is not some isolated example of the Bush administration's intransigence on this. We had Secretary Bodman, just to know, Mr. Johnson, you're not alone in this. We had Secretary Bodman in front of our Commerce Committee a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him if he'd read the IPCC report, and our Secretary of Energy said no. And I asked him if he read the executive summary, and he said no. And I asked him if he'd ever talked to the President of the United States, this is our Secretary of Energy, about how to fashion or whether to fashion a cap-and-trade system, and he said no. You're not alone in abject failure dealing with this mortal threat to the planet Earth. You are in a team of failure. And I have to say it bluntly because that is the circumstance. We don't have a lot of time here, and I just tell you that my constituents are most unhappy that the federal government's not following the law here.
Gentleman's time has expired. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Oregon, Mr. Walden.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I want to welcome the EPA administrator here today, and I appreciate the work your agency is doing. I think we're all trying to figure out how to work our way through this process and do what's right for the planet without destroying our economy in the process and letting other major world producer polluters like China and India get a free ride. I spent an hour in the former speaker's office meeting with the lead negotiator for China, who made it very clear that they expected us to do the heavy lift while they continue to pollute, while they continue to put new coal-fired plants online, about one a week or one every 10 days that are going to burn dirty coal, and they want to get away with that. And I'm not willing to sacrifice the economy for the people that I represent. I think there are things we can and should be doing. I think Congress in the last energy bill took up the mantle and helped move some of those things forward with conservation efforts, an emphasis on renewable energy. My district is home to a number of options for renewable energy. I want to know why we're not doing more to manage America's public forests better, why we allow the greenhouse gases to go up there when the fires come out. Forest Service spends 47% of its budget fighting fire. 9 million acres went up last year. That's all emissions into the atmosphere. We're not properly managing America's forests, and anybody that studied this issue knows the importance of healthy, green, growing forests as carbon sequesters. We need to change forest policy as well. Now, I know you don't have jurisdiction over that, but as we look at these issues, I think it's incredibly important to look broadly, not throw stones at each other, but say, where can we work together to do the right thing for the planet, the right thing for the environment, and not self-destruct our economy? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman's time has expired. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Missouri, Mr. Cleaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ranking Member Sensenbrenner. In particular, I would like to thank Administrator Stephen Johnson for returning to the Select Committee to update us on the EPA's endangerment findings. He indicated when he was here last summer that update was proceeding. It is my hope, and I believe the hope of this committee and the need of this nation, that Secretary Johnson will be able to give us an indication of what the EPA has discovered in their analysis and how it will affect future policy. Now, I recall that the administrator acknowledged that global warming and greenhouse gas emissions are serious issues, and I'm encouraged that Mr. Johnson and I agree on that issue. However, I am awaiting a commitment by the EPA and the administration in general to do something to combat this reality. If the Environmental Protection Agency will do what it was created to do, it will protect the environment. The American people expect and deserve more from their government than what the administration is willing to give, even in the face of the scientific reality of climate change. I look forward to and thank in advance our second panel for testifying before this committee today and for offering insight on the Supreme Court decision and on the future of U.S. energy policy and regulations. I anticipate that we can work together in forming the effective energy and environmental policy in order to protect our citizens and our planet. The Supreme Court decision we discussed today was monumental, and I hope that we can build on this judgment on a national scale. I thank all of our witnesses for being here today, and I look forward to becoming dialogical after your presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gentleman's time has expired. The chair recognizes the gentlelady from Tennessee, Ms. Blackburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the hearing today, and I want to say welcome.
Is the gentlelady's microphone on?
Yes, sir, it is.
Okay.
Maybe I should use the voice that I use when I'm trying to call the kids to the house, right? Speak a little louder.
That mother's voice is the most powerful
voice. The mother's
voices
are always the most powerful voice on the face of the earth.
Maybe you should move over one microphone. I don't think they can hear you back there.
Let's see. That mic seems to be working a bit better. We know that we're going to examine the implications of the Massachusetts versus EPA decision today, and I think that it is of particular interest to all of us about whether the EPA will regulate CO2 as a pollutant under Section 202 and look at that as a pollutant that endangers the health of the American public. If it does, then practically every business in every large facility is going to be subject to additional regulations. Many people know these are going to be heavy regulations and permitting requirements, and there is some anxiousness about that. These facilities that we're discussing emit more than 250 tons of CO2 per year. And under Section 202, they would have to obtain a prevention of significant deterioration permit and control technology requirements if they undertake any modifications that increases their CO2 emissions. And I think, sir, you can understand why there is a bit of anxiousness around this. And any facility would also need to obtain a PSD permit before it can be built and would have to comply with technology requirements. These effects will go farther than the proposal by former President Bill Clinton, who said that we must slow down. We must not slow down the economy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So there's a little bit of head scratching and a little bit of uncertainty that is taking place. We fear it could shut down the economy, but the U.S. currently faces several existing threats to its national security. Everyone is concerned about proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. They're concerned about terrorism. We hear about security every single day. And to drastically change our economy and devote significant time and resources to speculative dangers such as CO2 and climate change is something that people are not certain they want to do right now. If imminent threats are not addressed, the global warming issue will be moot. Mr. Chairman, even if the Earth continues to warm and possibly cause events that threaten national security, the predicted outcomes are at best tentative, and the proposed solutions raise problems of their very own. The EPA should resist any attempts to regulate CO2 as a pollutant and instead should focus its resources on real, immediate, and measurable environmental dangers, not on ones that may or may not happen in the future. I yield back.
Gentlelady's time has expired. The chair recognizes the gentleman from New York State, Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would say that climate change is a real danger that is happening. It's obvious to me and my constituents. It's obvious to those who read the literature. It's obvious to the vast majority of scientists who have studied the issue, especially those who are not being employed by oil companies or others who benefit from the current energy policy that we have. And it's also, I think, you know, when you talk about national security, the risk to our national security, probably the main one is the fact that we're spending billions of dollars a day to buy oil from unstable or despotic regimes in unstable parts of the world. And that's money that we don't have, that we're borrowing from the Chinese and other countries, thereby losing our sovereignty in the process because we can't be honest with, for instance, the Chinese about Tibet or Darfur or North Korea, or they're arresting their own meditators in the park and taking them off to be re-educated, quote-unquote. And at the same time, we can't be honest with the Saudis either about the madrasas and the funding of Islamic young people who are then trained to hate or attack American, Israeli, or other interests in the West or in the Middle East. And then as Tom Friedman writes in his columns, we have to finance the other side of the war on terror too by sending our troops and spending $12 billion right at the moment fighting the wars that are currently in progress every month. And that is one of... think the main drivers of the economic problems we find ourselves in, as well as the environmental problems we find ourselves in. These are both threats to national security, and to our economic security. I contend, of course, that we are on now is unsustainable. I also believe that we can work together and ultimately will work together to find solutions that will actually create jobs rather than destroying jobs. That's what happened with the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, with seatbelts, with the airbags, with all the proposals the industry cried were going to kill their economic prospects and instead created whole new industries and new kinds of jobs in this country. And I look forward to our finding those solutions. I think the chairman yield back.
The gentleman's time has expired. The chair sees no other members who are seeking recognition for the purpose of making an opening statement. So we will turn to our first witness, who is Stephen Johnson, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. We welcome you back to the committee, sir. Whenever you are ready, please begin.
Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss EPA's response to several important developments concerning the challenge of climate change. Let me begin by saying I agree that climate change is a global challenge. And just as President Bush recognized during the last September's major economies meeting, I believe the leading countries of the world are at a deciding moment when we must reduce greenhouse gas emissions instead of allowing the problem to grow. I also agree the United States must take the lead in reducing greenhouse gas emissions by pursuing new quantifiable actions. For example, the President committed the United States to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles as part of a national approach to address global climate change. And so I applaud Congress for answering the President's call to increase fuel and vehicle fuel economy standards as part of last December's Energy Independence and Security Act. Also on the national level, EPA began to work with the Department of Energy, Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Transportation last summer to develop regulations that would cut greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles and fuels. And due to the changes in the law created by the Energy Act, we are working to implement these new responsibilities. As you know, the Energy Act increased the renewable fuel standard from 7.5 billion gallons by 2012 to 36 billion gallons by 2022. Since there are a number of significant differences between the provisions of the Energy Act and the fuels program EPA was developing under the President's 20 and 10 plan, EPA must perform substantially new analytical work. This work includes analysis of renewable fuel lifecycle emissions, costs and benefits of Energy Act fuel volumes, and the environmental, economic, and energy security impacts of these fuel volumes. The Energy Act did not change EPA's general authority to regulate air emissions from motor vehicles and from motor vehicle engines. However, it did alter the Department of Transportation's authority to set mileage standards for cars and trucks, which is the primary way emissions of CO2 are reduced from new motor vehicles. The energy bill directs the Department of Transportation to set CAFE standards that ultimately achieve a fleet-wide average fuel economy of at least 35 miles per gallon by 2020. This new statutory authority has required DOT to review the previous regulatory activities that it had undertaken pursuant to an executive order. Since both the executive order and the Energy Act require close coordination between EPA and other federal agencies, it is necessary for EPA to work with DOT on new standards to comply with the law. The agency recognizes that the new energy law does not relieve us of our obligation to respond to the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts versus EPA. And as we work to develop an overall approach to address greenhouse gas emissions, we appreciate that a decision regulating greenhouse gas emissions from any mobile source would impact other Clean Air Act programs and many industrial sources. Therefore, It is vitally important EPA consider our approach from this broader perspective. While I continue to consider an overall approach, EPA has begun implementing mandatory steps to address greenhouse gas emissions, which include the renewable fuel standard, which significantly increases the volume of renewable fuels that has a lower greenhouse gas footprint than traditional fuels. Collaboration with the Department of Transportation as it sets the new CAFE standards of at least 35 miles per gallon. Carbon sequestration storage regulations to ensure our drinking water is protected as we reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And developing the greenhouse gas inventory as part of the omnibus appropriation legislation. In addition, we're making progress in evaluating the availability and potential use of various Clean Air Act authorities for greenhouse gas mitigation efforts. For example, we've compiled publicly available data on potential greenhouse gas emissions across industrial sectors. We've evaluated the use of surrogate data to predict potential carbon dioxide emissions. In view of these potential effects of Clean Air Act regulation, EPA is continuing to evaluate the availability and potential use of various Clean Air Act authorities for greenhouse gas mitigation to determine the best overall approach for handling the challenge of global climate change for all sources, both mobile and stationary. And I will keep the committee apprised of our progress. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. Before I take questions, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask that my full written statement be submitted for the record.
Without objection, so ordered.
Thank you.
The chair now recognizes himself for a round of questions. Mr. Johnson, as you well know, the committee invited you to testify at this hearing on January 15th, 2008, and in my letter of invitation, I asked you to provide the committee prior to this hearing with a copy of the EPA's draft rule to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles. The committee's letter noted that the rule had already cleared internal reviews and had been forwarded to the Department of Transportation for review in December of 2007. By unanimous consent, I move that the committee's correspondence with EPA be made part of the record of this hearing. Without objection, so ordered. On January 28th, we spoke by phone, and I reiterated my request for a copy of EPA's proposed rule. In addition, I requested that you provide me with a copy of EPA's proposed endangerment finding, which had been forwarded to OMB for review in December. You agreed to do so. But late last week, your staff informed committee staff that you would not be providing those materials, and in a subsequent letter to the committee, you indicated that you are asserting that these materials are, quote, pre-decisional, and hence cannot be shared. On March 7th, the committee sent you a letter stating, quote, if the basis for withholding these documents is a claim of executive privilege, then please advise on when that determination was made and the process you went through to substantiate your claim. You have yet to respond to that request. My first question, will you commit to providing the Select Committee with copies of both the EPA's proposed rule to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles and its endangerment finding?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as I indicated my response of March 11th to the letters you're referring to, I apologize that there was a misunderstanding, but the agency has a long-standing practice regarding requests for documents that are related to preliminary rulemaking, and the documents that you requested fall very much in that category.
Well, as you know, pre-decisional is a concept that comes out of the Freedom of Information Act, but the committee did not request the documents under the Freedom of Information Act, but rather under House Resolution 202 and the rules of the House. So that concept on its own is simply inapplicable to a congressional request. Are you asserting that these are subject to executive privilege?
At this time, no, sir, I'm not asserting that these are part of an executive privilege, no.
Do you have any reason to believe that President Bush saw the documents that you are refusing to supply to the committee?
I don't know whether he did or didn't. As I've already indicated, that it is true that the agency was working on draft regulations, and as part of those draft regulations included endangerment. And as has been the routine practice of the agency, and certainly our historical practice, that as we address the Clean Air Act issue of endangerment, we accompany what our proposed regulations would be.
Do you have any
reason working on that? And the Energy Independence and Security Act changed what steps that we were taking.
Do you have any reason to believe that Vice President Cheney has seen these documents?
I don't know who has or who hasn't seen these documents. I am aware that we have prepared drafts. They were in preparation for the President's 20 and 10 plan, and the Energy Independence and Security Act answered the call of the 20 and 10, and we as an agency began focusing our attention on implementing the new legislation that you passed. And by the way, congratulations. As you well know, it's been 32 years since our nation has changed its CAFE standard, and for obviously energy security as well as environmental reasons, it's good that we're focusing our attention on renewable
fuel. And I appreciate that. So it seems to me that you presented the committee with a very difficult decision to make. The committee views very seriously your refusal to cooperate and your intent to interfere with the work of the committee on this important issue. The House is in recess after tomorrow, but I want to let all members know that when we return, we will take up this issue with all of our available resources and all of the authorities, including extraordinary authority given to this committee under the rules of the House. This is a subject that the American public have a right to know about, have a right to the documents that deal with this very, very important issue, and it's going to be very important for us to clarify whether or not there is executive privilege which is being exerted here, or it is merely the Freedom of Information Act. But in either instance, we intend on proceeding in a way that ensures that the public has access to these very important documents. My time for the first round has expired. Let me turn now and recognize the gentleman from Wisconsin, Mr. Sensenbrenner.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me say that the escalation that you have just announced is, I think, extremely disappointing. We do have an obligation to find out how the public interest is being served and to do oversight over agencies of the executive branch. But I think there are ways of doing oversight where we can make the executive branch better without escalating the matter into something that may end up in a contempt citation and a reference to either the Justice Department or the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. And I would hope that we would cool it and attempt to try to get to the bottom of this without a clash between the two branches of government on how far executive privilege goes and how far the constitutional responsibility for Congress to do oversight goes. That being said, let's get back to the issue at hand. Mr. Johnson, would you agree that the inclusion of a number of major sources of greenhouse gas emissions that are going to potentially fall under the new regulation of greenhouse gases could significantly impact economic development and good jobs in this country?
Yes, depending upon decisions that are made under the Clean Air Act, could have significant economic consequences for a nation.
Now, under any law authorizing the EPA to take action, is there any provision to allow you to take into account the possible negative impact of an EPA decision on jobs or on the economy?
Well, in some parts of the Clean Air Act specifically, we are, in fact, required to take costs and benefits into consideration. Other parts of the Clean Air Act, such as the National Ambient Air Quality Standard, Section 108 of the Clean Air Act, which I made the decision on ozone yesterday, prohibits me by law from considering costs or implementation issues in setting a standard. So it depends upon what part of the Clean Air Act that a pollutant is regulated.
Now, assuming we are dealing with the regulation of greenhouse gases under the part of the Clean Air Act that allows economic impact to be considered, as you are working through possible regulations relating to greenhouse gas emissions, is it possible to include anti-backsliding provisions that would not impose new regulations until our competitors in the international globalized marketplace, like China and India, also do the same thing?
Well, one, I don't believe our existing Clean Air Act provides that kind of authority, but that's a very important issue, as we consider what we do nationally under the Clean Air Act, and certainly as members of Congress that you consider legislation. The notion of, it's sometimes referred to as leakage, in other words, those industries and things go to another country, the country that is not taking aggressive steps as the United States is in regulating greenhouse gases. And so since it is global climate change, we lose the businesses, we lose the economics, and the environment hasn't changed. And so that leakage is a significant issue that we need to make sure we're aware of and deal with.
Do you think the Clean Air Act should be amended so that you can take into consideration the exodus of jobs as a result of the EPA taking action, whereas our competitors in the globalized marketplace will not be taking similar action?
Well, that's one of the issues that, as I am taking a step forward and looking at the impacts of the Supreme Court decision and what it would mean of an endangerment finding and what that means on all parts of the Clean Air Act, that's one of the many issues that that looking at, and whether the Clean Air Act is actually the best tool for addressing greenhouse gases, or whether in fact
my time is about up. You know, let me make the observation that the constructive way to go about dealing with these issues is to approach the entire issue with the philosophy that we can have a clean environment and a healthy economy providing good jobs to American workers at the same time. I believe that's what our committee should be working on, rather than making threats and talking about contempt citations and reference to the Justice Department or the District Court for the District of Columbia. I yield back the balance of my time.
The gentleman's time has expired. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Missouri, Mr. Cleaver.
Mr. Johnson, do you believe that the United States now stands on moral high ground with regard to the issue of greenhouse gases? Are we in a position where we can discuss with India, China, some of the other Asian Pacific countries, the need for them to make dramatic changes in what they're doing, the enormous number of coal-fired power plants that was mentioned earlier that are under construction in China? So do we stand on moral high ground on the issue of reducing greenhouse gases?
Mr. Cleaver, I honestly do, and I do for a number of reasons. One, as a nation, by the President's leadership and by members of Congress passing budgetary appropriations, we as a nation from 2001 to today have spent or are spending upwards of $45 billion on addressing climate change. That's both investing in technologies, investing in science, even providing tax incentives for these new technologies or for people to do the right thing. There's no other nation in the world, no other nation in the world, that is spending that kind of money and investing those kinds of tools. In addition, we've set a goal, the President set a goal, of 18% reduction by the year 2012. We're on track to not only meet that, but to beat that goal. In addition, when you look at the array of programs, we have, I just went through in my oral testimony, a host of mandatory programs from renewable fuel to new CAFE standards, which is the primary way that we can reduce CO2 emissions from automobiles and light trucks. Carbon sequestration is the great hope for many of our stationary sources. Well, in order for us to be able to do that, one, we need the technology, but second, from an EPA perspective, we need to make sure that there's a regulatory framework in place to assure that when it's captured in a cost-effective way, it can be stored safely so that it won't harm the environment or people. And we've issued guidance so that pilot programs can go forward under the Department of Energy. And we're now drafting regulations, which I expect to be available for public comment later this year. And so we're taking aggressive steps, both mandatory as well as voluntary, and I hope everybody knows about our Energy Star program so that consumers can make the right choice, save themselves some money, and also save the environment. But those are all just a short list of things that we're doing at EPA and what we're doing nationwide. And yes, more can be done, and that's what we're debating now, and I think that's a healthy debate.
I'm asking you now to speculate, and so that if that's unfair, I apologize in advance. But why do you think that leaders in the Western world continuously admonish us to take the lead in reducing greenhouse gases? Chairman Markey and I listened to Ms. Merkel in Germany make that statement. The new president in Australia make that statement. The members of the European Union make that statement. The members of Parliament made that statement. Why do you think they are encouraging us to take the lead if we have this overwhelming picture, overwhelming number of programs and projects that the world should be able to see? What is preventing them from seeing the leadership we're making?
Well, I think that they now see and in fact support the president's efforts under the major economies efforts.
But major
economies, including Germany, including the ones that you just mentioned.
But we were just in Australia 2 months ago.
Well, I was just going to say, to work together, that to establish targets, goals in the future, mandatory targets in the future that would require all the nations to meet. But there are some fundamental pieces that need to be put in place, whether it's registries, making sure that we know how to actually, and we're all measuring greenhouse gases in the same way. We understand that each country is perhaps in a different economic, certainly in a different energy source. The United States, about 50% of our electricity comes from coal. We have an over 200-year supply of coal. So from an energy security and from an environmental standpoint, it's not to walk away from coal, it's to clean it up. And of course, through the Department of Energy and others, investing in clean coal technologies. And that's going to be critical, not only for energy security, but it's going to be critical for environmental problems.
That's a decade away, at least. According to scientists.
Well, and you raise a good point. We have been asked, and as an agency, we have done some detailed analysis of a number of pieces of legislation. We are in the process of completing an analysis of legislation now, and through that analysis, it shows that one, there is no silver bullet to addressing short-term silver bullet, and two. It is requiring significant investment in technologies And from nuclear to clean coal to others, solar and wind, are going to be the solutions to the problem.
Thank you.
Gentleman's time has expired. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Walton.
Thank you, and thank you for having this hearing. Mr. Johnson, I want to ask a couple of questions. One involves the issue of carbon sequestration and storage. Is the technology available today anywhere in the world to actually sequester and store carbon safely underground?
No.
What is your timeline do you see out there in terms of technological advancements to where we would have that technology available? What do your experts tell you?
Well, the experts in the energy field say that to have commercially available, cost-effective technology, we're at least a decade away, but I would defer to the experts. It's certainly not commercially and cost-effectively available today.
And when we entered into cap and trade to reduce other pollutants out of the atmosphere, how many in America, we created cap and trade originally.
That's correct.
How many power plants were involved in that? Do you remember?
I don't remember, but certainly our acid rain program and our cap and trade under our clean air interstate rule, which I signed, will result in a 70% reduction in SO2 and a 60% reduction in NOx. So it's a very effective program.
Is carbon dioxide a pollutant?
The Supreme Court has determined that it is, and so we accept the Supreme Court's decision.
And if it's a pollutant, can you put a pollutant in the ground?
Well, it's one of the important questions, and that under our UIC program, under our water program, that we believe that it can be, but it needs to be done, obviously, in accordance with law, EPA law.
And who has the liability if that pollutant escapes the ground?
Well, that's again, that's an important question that we're also addressing as part of our regulation.
Have you run any models, or are you aware of any models that have been run through the Warner-Lieberman legislation regarding cap-and-trade costs for power production?
We're finishing up that analysis in the next few weeks.
I was told
we'll be sharing that with you and look forward to giving you more detailed briefing.
I'd like to see that. I was told by a CEO of a major power company they've run their power costs through that model, and they go from 4.8 cents a kilowatt hour, as I recall the number, to 11.5 cents a kilowatt hour, which would be more than a doubling of the cost of electricity under that proposal. So that I mean, these are issues as we address trying to reduce greenhouse gases, and I bought a Prius here, and over the weekend bought a Ford Escape hybrid, traded in my other SUV. So I'm trying to do my part, and it's not cheap, but it's, I think, the right thing to do. But there are economic consequences here, there are pollution consequences here, and there are liability issues here that are very significant. When we were in Europe as part of a trip that Chairman Boucher organized, this issue of underground putting a pollutant underground without proper regulatory framework, the issue of liability if that pollutant were to escape into the atmosphere, and if you get credit for storing the carbon underground and it escapes, do you lose the credit? What's the mechanism down the road if that pollutant escapes? All of those issues were issues that I know the Europeans are trying to deal with, and that's why I ask you those questions today. How are we dealing with those? Because you could quickly get a regulatory framework or a legal framework in place and yet not have the technology, not have the liability, not have the storage capacity in place to actually make that something we could implement. And we know the costs are going to be there on the economy. Is that correct?
Those are all very good observations, and why it is so critical. While we have a serious issue of climate change, it's critical that we work our way through these because it can have significant economic consequences on our nation.
How did the energy bill that we passed and I supported that became law, the President signed, affect your agency as you were working on these rules the Chairman has asked you to provide information on?
Well, it significantly altered what approach that we were taking. For example, on the renewable fuels, we were looking at an open market system, looking at a variety of ways of trying to measure the CO2 emissions. Congress made a decision, and there are both a mandatory requirement on the total volume, there are specific mandatory requirements on types of biofuels, for example, and also made the decision that we will use a full life cycle analysis which the United States has never done before. And so there are some significant issues, and we're fully supportive of renewable fuels, but it's the work that we've done. We've got to do a lot of rework to be able to put out an implementing regulation.
And I know my time's expired. I had one other line of questions. I'll just submit them to your staff, and if you can get back to me on
please,
that,
I'd
appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman's time has expired. Over on the House floor at this moment, a moment of silence is being observed on behalf of our troops, wherever they are serving us in the world. I think it's appropriate for us to all, at this moment, for a minute, to observe a moment of silence in prayer and thought about them. Thank you all very much. The chair will now recognize the gentleman from the state of New York, Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Administrator Johnson, for being here, and with great respect and meeting this all in a good way.
Thank you.
I'm just curious. We've seen charts here earlier hearings of the last 20 years electricity demand in California versus, which is essentially flat, versus the increasing electricity demand in the rest of the United States. I'm sure you've seen the same studies, and I'm curious what your analysis or you could just a short version of what the reasons for that are.
Well, it's clear that economic growth requires energy, and that as our nation continues to grow as we want it to economically, that we need energy supplies. And given the energy security issues that and a variety of issues, that poses problems for the United States. And from an environmental standpoint, my area, we want to see and make sure that any future energy supplies are moving in the direction of clean energy supplies and making sure that
we're
investing.
Excuse me, I only have limited time, but my question was about the past 20 years, which I'll just state my theory. California has had stricter energy regulation and more state incentives and perhaps more of a consciousness about efficiency, and they have managed to grow. They have flat screen TVs, they have high tech, they have industry, they're not a third world country, and yet their electricity has gone a little bit up and down, but basically been flat for the last 20 years as the rest of the country has been on an incline increase path. State Air Resources Board and other regulations done on the state level, I think, have contributed to their keeping their own demand while flat, while allowing their economy to grow. Is that a wild theory, or?
Well, I shouldn't probably speculate on that, but what I can say is that from an environmental standpoint, while they've made progress in a number of the priority pollutants, unfortunately, parts of California today have some of the worst air in the entire United States. And that is that's a challenge for the state, and certainly it's a challenge for our nation.
Yeah.
And specifically, since I made my decision on reducing the health protective standard, that is making it more protective on ozone yesterday, it makes it more of a challenge for those parts of our country, for example, California, to achieve this new health protective standard.
Sure. Yeah, it's a complicated question, I understand. In New York last year, for the first time, we had several days in the summer when there was a air quality alert on the entire state, not just the cities where one might expect it, but open forest and farmland in upstate New York was looking at unsafe, you know, warnings for people with respiratory problems and elderly people and so on to stay indoors in farm and forest country upstate, far from any development where you wouldn't expect it. But I understand members of the administration have referred to the obligations for cooperation and rulemaking from the Energy Independence and Security Act as a reason why the action in response to the Supreme Court's ruling was delayed. But short of final regulations, EPA has not even made an endangerment determination. Remedies aside, the IPCC, the Supreme Court, and numerous others have recognized that greenhouse gases contribute to climate change, and that climate change presents a severe threat to our way of life. The passage of legislation doesn't change those facts, and they seem like the only ones that you would need to make this determination. So my question is, why hasn't EPA taken this step?
Well, as I've already testified, that with the passage of the Energy Independence and Security Act, we have now focused our attention on implementing that legislation. As I said, for cars, the primary source of carbon dioxide, the way to reduce that carbon dioxide is through improved fuel economy. And of course, we now have a 35 mile per gallon standard. So we think that it's important for us to work with the Department of Transportation to make that happen.
Yeah, I'm driving an American, Detroit-built hybrid that's rated at 33 today, 12 years out from that 2020 goal. So I believe that we can exceed the 2 miles per gallon. This is an SUV, four by four. It's not a teeny tin can. I believe we can exceed the margin, just as Texas exceeded the renewable electricity standard that President Bush signed into law when he was governor of Texas, and as partly as a result, Texas is now the leader in the nation in wind power. Mm-hmm. And when I heard Tibun Pickens had said that he's more excited about wind now than he is about any oil field he ever discovered, I know things are really changing. So I want to encourage you and offer you all the help that I can to there's way more to talk about than there is time that I have, so I'm afraid I have to yield back, but thank you again for being here, and I yield back.
Thank you.
The gentleman's time has expired. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Oklahoma, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate you being here today. A lot of people ask the questions I was wanting to ask, but I just have a couple. When you go through this, and it is complicated and it's tough, and you're looking at the regulatory regime framework that you're looking to implement, is there any consideration about how those will impact the economy or jobs or anything like that? Is that done in your office?
Well, ultimately, if the agency makes the decision to regulate, again, depending upon what part of the Clean Air Act, as I said, that under the NAAQS or National Ambient Air Quality Standards, I'm prohibited by considering costs or implementation. And the standard that I set on ozone yesterday was just purely health-based, requisite to protect public health with an adequate margin of safety. Other parts of the Clean Air Act allow that, and that's one of the pieces that I think it's so important, and that's why I've taken a step forward in looking at the entire Clean Air Act, because a decision on one part of the Clean Air Act could have lasting consequences and significant economic and unforeseen economic consequences. For example, one part of the Clean Air Act that, as it's described as significance levels, we don't have significance levels established for carbon dioxide. So the significance level would be zero. So that means any facility that would emit any carbon dioxide or any greenhouse gas, and remember there's six of them, would then trigger all of the regulatory framework of the Clean Air Act. And I think, as administrator, it's responsible. In fact, I think the public demands that I take a look at and understand before we rush to judgment on using the Clean Air Act tool in sorting through important issues, and I understand we have a responsibility of MASS versus EPA to respond, but it's important for us to look at that. In the meantime, obviously, I described all the significant things that we're doing to address greenhouse gases and also putting in place a necessary framework as we move forward as a nation.
That's good. And I guess just one other. When Congressman Walden was talking about the carbon sequestration, which I think is interesting, and you did state that that is going to be, when it's used, it's several years away before that's developed in a way we don't even know where to store it. where do you see as potential places to store it, like what kind of formations in the earth or anything like that? And also, could you address another application of carbon sequestration? Would be in my state, you mentioned some pilot programs. We're going to do one on enhanced oil recovery, injecting it into old wells. And can you comment on how that all works too?
Yes. As a nation, we have decades of experience of, and around the world, a number of countries do as well, have decades of experience of using CO2 as enhanced oil recovery. In looking at long-term storage, we're learning from that experience. And the type of formation is a hard rock formation that does not have, if you will, the leaks and crevices so that it would escape. And so as we've looked at what are those kind of formations, we have a pretty good idea, but there are still a number of issues that we have to sort through. And the other part of it is that when you look at the world at large, let alone the United States, and certainly the rapidly developing economies that we're well aware of, we're literally talking about gigatons of carbon dioxide that we're going to have to deal with. And you can translate those gigatons into, well, how many nuclear power plants would the world be required to build to address those gigatons, or how many zero-emission coal-fired power plants. The numbers are staggering. And so, as I said to Congressman Cleaver, unfortunately, there's no silver bullet. Clearly, in the long term, it is technologies, it is investing in nuclear and solar and wind and hydroelectric and all of these sources, and taking incremental steps, the kind of incremental steps that we're taking.
Is there some CO2 or carbon already injected in some formation that's being monitored now, seeing if it works? I mean, is that happening?
Yes. In fact, it recently issued some guidance so that the Department of Energy can do, I'm not sure the number of pilots, whether it's 6 to 12, but certainly a number of pilots on the issue of carbon sequestration and storage, and so we've provided guidance to allow those pilot programs to proceed. And of course, on the liability issue that was issued, it's my understanding that as part of those pilots, that the government is helping on that issue of liability.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. The gentleman's time has expired. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Washington State, Mr. Inslee.
Thank you. I've been told that on November 8, 2007, you said, quote, "I have committed to members of Congress and to the President that we will have that proposed regulation out for public notice and comment beginning by the end of this year and to work toward a final rule by the end of the year, by the end of next year," close quote. Did you say that?
Yes, I did.
And were you just teasing at that time?
I don't necessarily appreciate the way that you characterized that, but no, I was not.
So somebody got to you between you saying that and between now when you do not intend to have this done. Is that the situation?
Well, actually, you correctly noted that. Somebody got to me, and it was Congress and the President by passing the Energy Independence and Security Act.
So do you think the Supreme Court basically, you thought the Supreme Court is teasing then? You think they're teasing when they said you've got a legal obligation to do this, whether or not Congress acted something in the CAFE standard? Do you think they're teasing?
No, again, when you pass, and I said congratulations, it's good that Congress and the President signed the energy legislation, but it clearly changed the path that the agency was on. I also, as I stated in my testimony, I recognize the agency still has an obligation to respond to the Supreme Court. And as I also stated in my testimony, it's that it's very evident that as one looks at the Clean Air Act, there are many interconnections, and that a decision on one part of the Clean Air Act could have significant consequences, both into how greenhouse gases are regulated, as well as other unintended consequences, perhaps such as significant economic harm.
Well, I'm sorry, but that just does not wash with my constituents, and I'll tell you why. You're telling us that you intended to have a regulation, and then Congress did one of the things that perhaps you could have regulated, And the fact that they'd already checked off that box made it slower for you to do the regulation. The fact that we'd already accomplished one of the steps retarded your ability to move forward. That makes no sense whatsoever. If you've got five things you need to do, and Congress already did the first one, it shouldn't make you slower, it should make you faster. And you should have been back here and said, thanks, Congress, you did one of the things, you've accelerated my ability to get this regulation out. Something happened here that you've just decided not to do this, and it's pretty clear. And I'm disappointed by that, because you're the fireman. You're the fireman, and the planet's on fire right now. You don't pick up a hose, you don't pick up an axe, you don't pick up a water bucket, you do nothing. The administration has done nothing about this before the Supreme Court decision or after the Supreme Court decision. Now, you could at least take some action, for instance, dealing with coal plants that are continuing to be built with no sequestration. You haven't done that. You haven't done anything. I mean, isn't that true? You haven't issued any regulation at all, have you?
Well, sir, I respectfully disagree that, as I said, I appreciate and applaud Congress for passing the legislation, but in doing so, you require us to write regulations, and that's what I just testified. That's exactly what we're doing. We're writing regulation. We're writing a regulation to implement the renewable fuel standard.
So you told
us we're writing a regulation to implement through the Department of Transportation, through the CAFE program. We're working with them. You required us through our omnibus appropriation to write and establish a greenhouse gas registry. We're doing that. And as I've also testified, that we recognize that carbon sequestration is going to be a critical component as we look to the future of addressing greenhouse gases. We've issued guidance so pilots can go forward. We're writing regulations. I said that later this year you'll see the draft regulations on that. So we are not idly sitting by, and that's just on the domestic front. I can talk more about that.
Will you be writing a regulation on a cap and trade system?
We have made no decision as to what the next steps we're going to take with regard to MAS versus EPA and the Supreme Court decision. That is an important question,
which we've not answered yet. A no decision in March of 2008 is a decision. A no decision today is a decision by the Bush administration to finish its term without taking meaningful greenhouse gas action. And this was the last gasp effort or chance for this administration to salvage a positive legacy of its failures in 7 years. A last chance. And you're letting it go by. And history is going to record this administration and your term in office, if you don't act on this, as a failure and an existential threat to civilization on this planet. And I just hope maybe someday you personally wake up to that effect and march into the White House and saying, I'm doing a reg and I'm going to get it done and it's going to go into effect. And if not, tender your resignation. That's a responsible thing to do, and you haven't done it yet. And I hope you start to rethink your obligations.
The gentleman's time has expired. We will go to a second round of questions, the chair will recognize himself. When you last appeared before the select committee, you would not say whether or not you believed that greenhouse gas emissions cause or contribute to air pollution, which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. 9 months have gone by since you last appeared before the select committee. You put 3 or 4 full-time staff members on this question for several months. Your staff has told Congress that you reviewed all materials and agreed to forward a positive finding of endangerment to OMB in December. Are you prepared to tell the select committee right here, right now, that greenhouse gas emissions cause or contribute to air pollution, which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare? Yes or no?
The answer is no, and it would be inappropriate for me to prejudge a preliminary draft regulatory decision that has not gone through the appropriate process or been published for notice and comment.
So you're saying that you can't even tell the select committee when you will be ready to make this determination, though you spent all of last summer and fall assuring Congress that it would be done by the end of the year. Why can't you even give us a date?
Well, the reason is, and I've tried to be very clear today, is that as we move forward with evaluating endangerment, and that it has implications for not only mobile sources, but it also has implications for stationary sources, and that I understand my responsibility to address the concerns by the Mass versus EPA, but I also understand my responsibility to recognize potentially the widespread implication and impact of such a decision, and that's what I'm evaluating.
Well, isn't it true that the only regulatory requirement, the publication of the endangerment finding triggers, is the requirement to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles?
What is before the agency is the issue of the Mass versus EPA, and as part of that, the very important question of endangerment, and that there are significant implications as to how, if, what the endangerment finding is addressed, given the intricacies and the interconnected of the Clean Air Act.
I understand what you're saying, but no stationary sources would be automatically or immediately subject to greenhouse gas regulations as a result of concluding that greenhouse gas emissions cause or contribute to air pollution, which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. Isn't that right?
Well, that's actually one of the questions that I'm looking at.
Okay, so let me continue to move forward then. The energy bill did not in any way alter your obligation to make the determination on whether greenhouse gas emissions cause or contribute to air pollution, which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. In fact, the energy bill says, quote, except to the extent expressly provided in this act or an amendment made by this act, nothing in this act or an amendment made by this act supersedes, limits the authority provided or responsibility conferred by or authorizes any violation of any provision of law, including a regulation, including any energy or environmental law or regulation. That includes the Clean Air Act, Mr. Johnson. So let me ask you again, since you already completed your work on the endangerment finding, and nothing in the energy bill impacts your responsibility to publish it or alters in any way the outcome of the simple question of whether greenhouse gas emissions cause or contribute to air pollution, which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare, when will the EPA publish its endangerment finding?
Well, as I've already stated, that in addressing the issue of endangerment, it was part of a regulatory package that was focused on addressing and implementing the President's 2010 plan. So while it's true that the Energy Independence and Security Act did not alter certainly that portion of the Clean Air Act, what is true is that it did alter what regulatory steps the agency is now taking with regard to renewable fuels and the government is taking with regard to the CAFE standard. And so the issue of endangerment, which, as I said, historic practice is it accompanies the regulatory effort, we are now looking at what are the appropriate next steps.
Well, you recently denied California's request to implement its greenhouse gas regulations for motor vehicles because you said California had not demonstrated, quote, a compelling and extraordinary need for the regulations. You did, however, say, again, quote, warming of the climate system is unequivocal, and cited numerous adverse impacts of climate change, such as rising sea levels, which is the Massachusetts case that was ruled upon by the Supreme Court, heat waves, more intense hurricanes, and increased wildfires and insect outbreaks, and even said that some of these impacts could lead to increases in mortality. Do you not believe that any of these factors you mentioned may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as I clearly point out both in my testimony as well as in my California waiver decision, the greenhouse gas emissions and global climate change is just that. It's global and it's a serious challenge. I also very clearly point out in my decision document that the California waiver does not reflect and should not be construed as my judgment on endangerment.
Well, again, there is a profound difference of opinion between the Select Committee and the EPA over this question, your responsibilities, the urgency of the problem, and whether or not you are discharging your responsibilities pursuant to a Supreme Court decision in Massachusetts versus EPA. And we intend on pursuing this question vigorously in the weeks and months ahead. Let me now turn once again and recognize the gentleman from Wisconsin, Mr. Sensenbrenner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, first of all, let me say I'm very disappointed that this hearing has become overly adversarial. I think we're all in the business together to try to provide a healthy environment and to try to figure out a way that the regulations can be promulgated in a manner consistent with the law as well as consistent with not only the Massachusetts versus EPA Supreme Court decisions, but other decisions of the court. Let me say that Congress bears a part of the culpability of the confusion that is being discussed here. First of all, the Clean Air Act has varying degrees and methods and modalities of regulation. You mentioned that yourself, where in some areas the Clean Air Act has a different regulatory mode than in other areas of the Clean Air Act. However, what's in the air is something that we all breathe. And as an administrator, it is your job to figure out how to go through the maze that Congress has given you, because the law was passed by Congress and your job is only to administer the law. The other thing is that the energy bill that was passed late last year, which I did not vote for, I think has complicated the issue and has required you maybe not to go all the way back to square one in making this determination, but certainly has required a retooling to make sure that the regulations comply with the new law that Congress passed. And so it's kind of like you ordering somebody to build a house for you, and the house goes up, and then you and your wife decide to have a whole lot of change orders. Well, you're not going to be able to move into the house as quick as you wanted until the builder is able to accomplish the change orders which you have ordered and which you will pay for. And then we get to the business of a cost-benefit analysis, which you alluded to in response to my earlier questions, where in some cases you cannot look at the impact on jobs for Americans, and in other cases you have to do that. So I can understand why there has been a delay in figuring out how all of this fits together and the fact that the rules changed at least slightly with the passage and signature by the President of the Energy Bill. Now, I don't think we in Congress should be berating administrators for not getting things done on time. We have a pretty poor record of getting things done on time ourselves. The appropriations bill, including the one that funded your agency, ended up passing months late. And that's last year was not the only time that it was done. So I guess I can say that the one question that I have, and maybe it will calm the two colleagues sitting to my right down, and it probably won't, but do you see light at the end of the tunnel in getting these regulations out, even though maybe some in the Congress are trying to turn the lights out?
I'm very optimistic, and I do see light at the end of the tunnel, and I see light at the end of the tunnel that as we have committee meetings such as this, oversight hearings such as we have the debate, that people recognize that yes, climate change is a serious challenge for our nation, and it's one that needs to be thought through, yes, expeditiously, but it needs to be thought through deliberately and to make sure that as we consider tools such as the Clean Air Act or other tools as Congress considers legislation, that we do so with all the foreknowledge and experience, so that we can make the best informed decisions, so that we can address the issue, but do so in a way that doesn't hurt our economy, doesn't hurt our nation, and in fact ends up helping the global challenge.
So what can Congress do to keep the light at the end of the tunnel on?
Well, I think certainly give me some time to think through under the Clean Air Act what is an appropriate approach. I know that there is a desire for me to rush to judgment. This is a very complex issue, and it's a very difficult issue, and one that's been debated since 1978.
My time is about up. If you do things prematurely and you make a mistake, is there a danger that a court will enjoin you from implementing a mistake, and then we have a further delay?
Well, in my 27 years at EPA, one of the things that I clearly note is that our agency is frequently subject to litigation. And I am a true believer that the air, nor the water, nor the land get any better or improve when we're sitting in a courtroom. So my preference is let's work together to address the problem. In my experience, working collaboratively, you can address the problem faster and even cheaper, and I think it ends up better for the nation.
Thank you, sir.
The chair once again recognizes the gentleman from Washington State, Mr. Inslee.
Thank you. Some of us believe that when a fellow's been in the White House since January, I think 20th, 2001, it's not a rush to have expected some action to deal with a planetary emergency by March 2008. And I'm trying to figure out why the director of the Environmental Protection Agency is not acting as a fireman here, but in fact just as, frankly, sort of a defender of a bureaucracy that has not moved in 7 years. And I'm trying to figure that out, so I'm going to ask you a couple questions. We had Dr. Pachauri of the International Panel on Climate Change here a couple months ago. He sat just where you're sitting right now. He told us that 20 to 30% of the world's species could be extinct if we don't reduce our emissions by about 20% below 1990 levels by around 2020. Pretty stunning statement. Have you read the IPCC report? The most recent IPCC report?
Yes, I have.
And do you think Dr. Pachauri is right in that regard?
Well, as part of the IPCC process, in fact, we have a very well-respected EPA scientist that participate. And so I believe that the IPCC report represents among the best available science that is available to the governments.
And do you think we should be making policy decisions on that basis?
Well, I think that the IPCC reports are important data sources, scientific analyses on which the countries can use to help base their decisions. But I mean, the good news is that, and certainly as the IPCC points out, that additional research needs to be done, and in fact, we're all doing that. Additional work needs to be done in emerging technologies. That's being done. And so all of those factors need to be taken into consideration as whether the United States or a rapidly developing economy decides what is the best approach for it
and isn't
for addressing
it,
this issue.
I'm sorry. Isn't it true that under the path that your administration is now on, we don't have a hope in the world of preventing those dire consequences if we continue on the path that your agency is now on?
Well, I would disagree with the characterization, because we are on a path to improve the fuel economy standards since the first time in 32 years. That is the primary tool for reducing greenhouse gases from automobiles and light trucks. We are on a path to implement a significant 36 billion gallon requirement for renewable fuels.
Are you on a path to achieve 20% reductions in CO2 emissions below 1990 levels by 2020? Are you telling American taxpayers that your policies are going to achieve that?
Well, the target that the president has set is a 18% greenhouse gas intensity reduction by the year 2012, and as a nation, we're on track to meet or exceed that.
So your answer to my question is no, is that right?
Well, I don't know whether, given the recent changes, whether that what specific number that achieves, but I can say with confidence that the steps that we are taking as a nation.
That's disappointing.
That we're taking as a nation actually move us in the direction of that we all know we need to be.
It is disappointing.
And that is slowing down and stopping and then ultimately reversing greenhouse gas emissions.
It is disappointing that the director of the Environmental Protection Agency cannot tell the citizens of this nation whether or not his policies are going to achieve that goal of 20% reductions below 1990 levels that the IPCC basically said we've got to have or have cataclysmic events. And you're telling me you can't tell me whether your policy is going to achieve that or not? I can tell you, and anybody who knows sixth grade arithmetic knows the answer to that, which is the answer is no. Now, I'm going to give you a moment to think about this just for a second. Realize the path we're on and tell me, is the answer yes or no, or you're just telling me the director of the EPA doesn't know the answer to that? Which is that?
Well, what I've told you repeatedly is that we are still sorting through what path we as a nation should be on. And that is that's the process that we're in right now. And I've also said that we've taken significant steps and, again, acknowledge the great work of Congress in passing this legislation that actually is directionally in that direction of reducing. So at this point, while we're trying to sort through what steps make sense for the nation, I can't say what percentage we should or shouldn't. Certainly, that will be a part of the outcome. Certainly, as you debate issues of legislation, that will be a significant issue that you're going to have to address as to what the target and what the requirements would be if you choose to proceed with legislation.
Well, that was a long no, but I'll take it. Have you read The 6 Degrees, Our Future on a Hotter Planet by Mark Linz? Have you read that book?
I have not.
I would commend it to you. If you read it, and if you follow the science in it, I think you'll conclude that your administration is woefully failing in its obligations to our grandkids. Thanks.
The gentleman's time has expired. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Missouri, Mr. Cleaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, do you have any idea how many lawsuits on greenhouse gas emissions, permits, and petitions that are facing the agency?
I know that, for example, we have 7 petitions that are pending before the agency that cover aircraft, ongoing marine vessels, non-road engines, for example, agriculture, farm construction, lawn garden equipment, recreational vehicles, recreation on smaller commercial marine vessels, locomotives. That's just on the mobile sources. In addition, we have, as I've said, we have the issues of and the implications on stationary sources. There are 90. There are, in fact, 90 stationary source categories, ranging from grade elevators to utility boilers and a lot in between.
Yeah. I guess where I'm going, you mentioned earlier about the CAFE standards.
Yes.
The truth of the matter is the CAFE standards that was approved in the energy bill was a result of work with the chairman of this committee, Mr. Dingell, and the Speaker of the House.
Congratulations.
Well,
it's great. It's a great success story.
I agree. We did a great job, if I have to say so myself. And, however, it seems to me that would have been the role of the EPA to push the government, Congress, in the direction of higher CAFE standards. And as a result, the EPA is serving as the tail light after the headlights have already flashed. And so I can't get past the issue of the United States having a high moral ground to talk to other nations about this issue, because we you mentioned a lot of money that has been spent.
Yes.
And that beckons an ideological discussion, because the administration says that when you throw a lot of money at a problem, particularly when we're talking about social issues, that it's wasteful. And so when you just talk about all of the money that is being spent, what is the difference between what you're saying about energy and what people say about money we spend in HHS?
Well, we're seeing the fruits of that investment, whether it's the science so that we can better understand climate change.
But you don't believe in the science.
Well, sir, I just have said over and over again that climate change, global climate change, is a serious challenge.
Does the White House believe that?
Yes.
Where can we find that?
Well, I'd be happy to provide for the record the president's statements that acknowledge that. But let me just point one thing so that to make it clear, EPA does not administer the CAFE standard. That
I understand.
That's the responsibility of the Department of Transportation.
Okay.
So, okay.
I understand that. The point I was trying to make, and perhaps poorly, is that we need the EPA to be the headlight, and I'm in disagreement with you that it is the headlight on these matters of environment.
Well, sir, actually, I like the headlight analogy, because that's precisely what I'm doing, is shining light on all the aspects of the Clean Air Act, including the endangerment, and looking at what is the best approach, recognizing the science, recognizing multiple petitions, the MAS versus EPA, and illuminating light as to what is the best direction that we as a nation should proceed with, given all of this. And that I understand people want me to drive into that dark alley because they think it's the right alley.
Yes.
I really am shining a light on and looking at what is the best approach. And I'm doing it deliberately, and I'm doing it expeditiously, and I would ask for indulgence to stay tuned.
Well, I appreciate the analogy. In my real life, I'm a preacher, and I like analogies, and that was pretty good.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. The alleyway. The alley. What recommendations can we expect from the EPA as a committee, as a Congress, that will move us toward reducing greenhouse gases?
Well, I think several. One is, as I said, that the steps that we're taking, renewable fuel standard, and that list of things, those mandatory responsibilities, you can expect that. Second is you can expect to hear from me as I have looked at and I'm looking at the Clean Air Act, what do I believe is the best approach for the nation, given all of those factors, and so you can expect to hear from me again on that. And then lastly, you can expect from me to continue to work with you, members of Congress, as you sort through the very important issue of legislation. We're doing some of the world's most extensive scientific and economic analysis that's ever been done on the issue of climate change. And I look forward to my staff having the opportunity to share, such as the Warner-Lieberman bill, so that you can be very, very informed as you have this important debate on legislation.
Okay, the gentleman's time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I thank you. And all time for questions by members of the committee has expired. Mr. Johnson, you're a scientist with a unique charge. The planet is sick. There are no hospitals for sick planets. The Congress has told you to do something about it. The Supreme Court has told you to do something about it. You've told this committee that you don't want to, in fact, make a rush to judgment. The problem is that the planet is on a rush to ruin, a rush to catastrophe, even as you say that you do not want to make a rush to judgment. This committee is very concerned that you do not understand that there are no emergency rooms for planets. We have to engage in preventative health care for the planet. We won't be able to deal with the catastrophic consequences once they occur. We have to stop them from happening. You have less than a year left to go, Mr. Administrator, to make the decisions that put the United States on a path of leadership rather than being the laggard in the world. The world is asking us to be the leader. Nothing in the energy bill, nothing in law prevents you from making these decisions. We urge you to make those decisions. We hope that you do not waste these last 10 months of your administration. But because of your testimony today and your lack of willingness to provide the documents which this committee needs, we are going to continue to pursue very aggressively this subject because time is of the essence. We are going to be asked in subsequent generations whether or not we really tried to prevent that catastrophe from occurring. And the least that we should be able to say is that we tried. Right now, there is no evidence on this question of endangerment to the public health and welfare that the EPA is acting consistent with the urgent threat to our planet that is clear from all scientific evidence. So we thank you for testifying before us today. We are going to be in frequent communication with you on this subject, which goes to the central issue of our generation. Have we dealt with this urgent threat to the planet? That is how we are going to be viewed by history. All other issues will be merely a footnote in history to the question of whether or not we dealt with this catastrophic threat to our planet. We urge you to act and to act soon on the issue. And we thank you for being before our committee
today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now we're going to turn to our second panel. How many votes are there? And how much time is left? Okay. Great. Thank you. Great. Thank you. We welcome the second panel on this very important subject. We are notified that there are two roll calls on the House floor. So what we'll do is we'll begin by hearing testimony from our first witness on the second panel. Then we'll take a brief recess and come back and complete the testimony. Our first witness, Ms. Lisa Heinzeling, is a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. She formerly served as Assistant Surgeon General for my home state, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, where she specialized in environmental law, and in which capacity she was the primary author of the successful Massachusetts versus EPA brief. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the
And if you could move that microphone up a little bit closer.
Thank you.
A little bit, just a little bit closer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In Massachusetts versus EPA, as we've already heard this morning, the Supreme Court held that the EPA has the authority to regulate greenhouse gas. The Supreme Court also held that any response to that decision...
Have you turned on the microphone down there?
The microphone button.
Uh-huh. Could you move that other microphone over, please? Thank you.
The EPA broke it.
Now, how's that? All right.
Thank you.
In Massachusetts versus EPA, the Supreme Court held that the EPA has the authority to regulate greenhouse gases. It also held that any response to the Supreme Court's decision and to that authority to regulate greenhouse gases must sound in the criteria of the statute itself. That is, cannot stray beyond the statutory criteria to other matters. The Supreme Court also gave the EPA very limited options on remand from that decision. Utter inaction was not one of those options.
Again, could you move that microphone in a little bit closer and maybe lower it a little bit? I think that might help.
Utter inaction was not one of those options. Yet that's what we've gotten from EPA. Indeed, the reasoning from Mr. Johnson this morning was exactly the kind of reasoning that the Supreme Court rejected in Massachusetts versus EPA. There, the EPA said that the problem of climate change was very big, it was very complicated, it might need a solution other than the Clean Air Act, the EPA was worried about the international context, and so on. These are the very kinds of reasons we heard from Administrator Johnson this morning. These are the very kinds of reasons the Supreme Court rejected almost a year ago. The Supreme Court held, again, EPA must hew its reasoning to the language of the statute, not stray beyond that, and cite other policy concerns in making its decision. On endangerment, the Supreme Court made clear that EPA's job is to assess the science and to follow the science where it leads. This morning, Mr. Johnson gave no justification for not doing that, for not making a finding that greenhouse gases may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. He conceded, I think, that the energy bill signed in December 2007 does not affect authority under the Clean Air Act, as well he should. He also, though, suggested that that bill affects his decision on remand from Massachusetts versus EPA. But there's no explanation from Mr. Johnson as to why he may not, at this moment, right now, make a finding that greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare. And indeed, there was no real explanation from Mr. Johnson as to why his February 29th decision denying California the authority to regulate greenhouse gases did not make such a finding. In that decision, he claimed it was likely that greenhouse gases were endangering all sorts of different aspects of human health and welfare. The finding was very formal. This morning he tells us it's not an endangerment finding. He may not avoid the consequences of his decision in February simply by giving it a label that he chooses. It was surprising to me to hear Mr. Johnson say he didn't want to prejudge the issue of endangerment when in February, I believe, that's exactly the decision he made. That is a judgment that greenhouse gases are endangering public health and welfare. In addition, the consequences we've heard of regulating that Mr. Johnson referred to this morning are not part of the statutory framework for finding endangerment. They simply are not part of that statutory scheme. Science is what he's supposed to follow, not the consequences of a regulatory scheme. And here I ask you simply to imagine you go to a doctor, the doctor tells you you have symptoms, has even told you on February 29th you're very, very ill. But he says some of the treatments, some of them, are very painful and expensive. And so he's decided he's not even going to tell you whether you're sick. That would be a bad doctor. I believe that is not a way an agency should behave. The EPA is our environmental expert. Many entities, businesses, states, other agencies depend on EPA's judgment about whether greenhouse gases are endangering public health or welfare. That finding would also, I think, I hope, influence EPA's own attitude towards regulation and change it from one of obduracy to urgency. They might change the attitude of EPA from asking, how can we avoid doing too much, to how can we find a way to do enough.
I'll tell you, what we're going to have to do right here, we'll stop, we'll come back to the other witnesses, we'll give you 1 minute to summarize your opening statement, then we'll go to the second witness. We're going to take a brief recess.
Thank you. Testing?
Is that working? That was they only have two in here, and if that didn't work for a second.
Okay.
So I think I'm going to
push another
working?
Is this working? Okay.